ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems, the smarter way to manage, maintain, and safeguard your aircraft's value. I'm one of your hosts today. My name's Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Sitting to my left here, returning for her third time as a guest host, we're getting closer to that smoking jacket coming up soon, is Margaret Breaux. She is our vice president of the Aviation Foundation. Margaret, you also have marketing and membership and all kinds of fun outward-facing stuff for our members.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on. I appreciate
you having me.
Flying my wing here today. So, and I always love episodes, and most of our episodes do have really amazing guests. And today is no different. Someone I'm very fortunate, both of us actually are very fortunate to call our friend, and that is Lieutenant Colonel Olga Custodio. Olga, thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's my honor and pleasure, and I can't wait to talk to you.
Well, thanks. I hope you got rested up from the journey out here yesterday.
Absolutely.
Oh, awesome. Well, it's my favorite question to ask everybody. Anybody that listens to this podcast knows I always lead off with it. Because everybody has such an interesting journey into aviation. What was your first inkling that you wanted to fly?
Well, I want to say that I got on an airplane at a very young age. You know, I was months old, traveling from Puerto Rico to meet my dad at his duty station. So I think that's when the seed was planted, and it grew and grew and grew. And sometimes you don't realize that seed's there until your experiences and the opportunities that you have to see airplanes, experience airports, and people who are flyers. And then you realize, wow, that's something that I want to do.
Wow. You know, and briefly touch on your dad's service, because your dad's service was really amazing as well.
Yes. Dad was a career soldier. He served about 23 years. And the thing about that is what inspired me to want to serve in the military. So I looked at him as my role model. Always look up to him. He's still alive. He's 99 years old. He fought in World War II, the Korean War, and after that is when I came into the picture. But every station that he was at, he tried his best to have the family with him, and I think that's the big thing, that we were able to experience that. And I lived around the world, you know. These are places where a lot of people know of because of the news, but never travel there. So it was quite an interesting childhood for me.
That had to be amazing to be, you know, we talk about, you know, so many times on this show, you know, the service life, the service personnel that are on, but, you know, for the families, that has to be pretty wild, like moving a lot, you know, trying to learn and do your schooling abroad. That had to be challenging and yet an adventure.
It was. And what was different is that, and it's something that, if you didn't know, April is the Military Child Month, and the military is celebrating that. And I had a chance to have a presentation or conversation, if you will, including my daughter this week. And it was about the military child. And so being a military child, being a parent as well of a military child, I understand the intricacies and the challenges that kids experience as they travel with their parents. And I think that's something that you kind of forget, you know, that these kids are trying to adapt to environments that wouldn't be normal for them. You know, if they lived in one place, went to one school, had these childhood friendships that they grew up with, and be able to carry kind of what you can call a normal childhood. And these kids are bouncing around, you know. But I feel in the moment, it's overwhelming sometimes for these kids, as it was for me. But it builds resilience, perseverance, and it helps you learn how to adapt to different situations.
Those are great qualities to have as you grow up, right?
Correct. Yes.
Would you say that aviation and then civic kind of duty, that military, that those were constants then for you and that sort of helped shape you too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I saw what my father did and I felt that he was representing the U.S. abroad, and I felt that, and I mm-hmm. felt that portion of me that made you feel proud of mm-hmm. who you were and what you were doing in these countries that you were trying to help them, you know, especially him. He was in communications.
Okay.
And so what you would call today cybersecurity, and
okay.
that was his specialty. So he knew all about Morse code and listening in, interpreting, and that sort of thing. But he would teach foreign troops in communication. And that's when the U.S. was abroad trying to work with their allies and the different stations that he was in, and teaching them as much as possible. So living in Taiwan, you know, when the U.S. was kind of ramping up mm-hmm. the military there and making sure that it was a stable country and self-sufficient, and as well as in Iran, we were there when the Shah was there. So it was a transition,
yeah,
especially in Iran, because mm-hmm. the riots were already starting and things were happening, and we could see that change,
yeah,
of climate in.
And to live it and then reflect back on it afterwards and say, whoa, I was day to day living in there, but then.
Right.
Yeah. The gravity right. of all of it afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. a different culture, you mm-hmm. know. So you learn to see people and respect them for who they are and what they believe in. Not that they're going to push that on you, but just respecting who they are and.
Just a worldview that you have that someone who is. In the same place their whole life doesn't have, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Gives mm-hmm. you perspective.
Yep.
Yeah. And appreciation for what we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important because living in one place, you'll only see one thing. Mm-hmm. You can read and hear, but experiences very different, very different. So you accumulate and you store all that information and experience, and it helps shape your mind and how you see other people in the world. And I think the big part of is respecting each other.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That is a really cool take on your childhood and really kind of reflective of a lot of the children that are grown up at military bases all around the world today. I mean, that's still, you know, relevant for them. That's really cool.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about when you decided to enlist in the military and maybe some of your first, impressions of what was your first few days in the military like?
Right. Well, my attempts were three. So it took me a while to open that door. It was very plain. And like I would always tell my kids when they wanted to do something, they said, I want to do this or that. And I'm like, okay, give me your plan. What is your vision? Because you can't go in there without a flight plan, if you will, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You just go in blindly and then, you know, you're going to crash and burn. So I would always ask them, what's your plan? So I had a plan. I had a vision for myself. Growing up in DOD schools, great schools. I mean, the education was second to none, if you will. So I graduated high school at 16 years old. I had enough credits to graduate. I was very young. So my only option was keep going to school, you know. But what was I going to do at 16? And so I kept studying. I said, okay, I'm going to go to university. I'm going to get a degree in math.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to join the ROTC. But that didn't work out. So I went ahead, went to school. Went to the ROTC building. Commander said, sorry, don't qualify. Moved on. Plan B. So plan A, plan B, right? And so I said, okay, what am I going to do to market myself when I graduate? You know, how can I get a job? What kind of
yeah.
profession am I going to be getting into? So I had to kind of switch over and I went to business And I got a minor in math still. I said, okay, this will work. And I moved on. Fast forward maybe 5 years or so later, I already married my husband. I guess about 5 years. So timeline's like, the thing is that we both worked for a commuter airline at the time.
Sure.
So he was at the air terminal. I worked in the accounting office, and we met in December, got married in March. So
that's quick.
Yeah. We've been married 51 years.
Oh, aww. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah. So that's a whole other story.
Different podcast.
Part two.
Yeah, right. That's a whole different story. But so about a year into the marriage and everything, we started talking, and he said, how about we join the military? And I'm like, count me in. Let's do this together. So we went, and that didn't work out because I had already gotten my degree, my AFOQT scores, you know, the entry exam. We got the highest scores, and the recruiter said, no, I can't offer you an officer commission. Why don't you enlist? Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with enlisting, but I knew that, you know, I was qualified for something more. Mm-hmm. And I was not going to accept anything less. You know, by that time, you're like, no, I know exactly what I want, and this is how it needs to be. So I said, well, I can serve my country being a military spouse. Like my mom did. And I thought, you know, great. So that's the choice. Moving forward, we're in Panama, the Canal Zone. That's his duty station. He got into airfield management. So we've been around aviation the
always.
Whole time. Always. Always. You know, he'd be the one out there going to air shows, taking pictures, and, oh, look at this air. I'm like, okay, honey, yeah, okay. So he was all in, you know, he loved it. And so having someone who loved aviation, I think, helped, you know, because we had that in common.
Oh, it's contagious, yes.
It is, right? Mm-hmm. Right? And, so we're in Panama. I finally decided what kind of career am I going to have. I became a civil servant, worked for DOD, and I worked at the air terminal. So, yes. So I saw pilots in and out, airplanes landing and all of that. And I was like, okay, this is fine. And then the opportunity came when the Air Force opened the undergraduate pilot training to women. Mm-hmm. And I found out. So I said, this is my chance.
Yep.
Third time's a charm. You know, right place, right time, right opportunity. And it's something that if I had been commissioned before, I don't know if I would have had this opportunity.
Sure.
So I think things happen because they have to, and they need to happen in that order. And it gives me perspective looking back when you're at the moment and they say no. What do you do? You know, you're like, well, I got rejected once. I got rejected twice.
Yeah.
You know, how am I going to make this happen? So I was all in. And that story of everything that happened at the moment I found out to when I actually got my notice that I had been accepted, it was the fastest 5 months that... That seemed like forever.
Oh, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was great, you know. And I had to go to a flight screening. I had to go to officer training to get my commission. And then finally started undergraduate pilot training. And so it was a dream come true, if you will, to see myself actually getting to fulfill that vision and dream and that I always saw myself in, that position. And I am so grateful, every time, you know, I think back on it. And some people ask, what would you have done different? I go, nothing, because here I am. This is what happened. What would you change, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, every experience makes you who you are.
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny, sometimes when those doors close, you just think, okay, well, that wasn't, but then you find a different door. You find a different way in. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So do you think your life sort of growing up on bases helped prepare you for, you know, entry into the Air Force? Did that, were you kind of like, you kind of knew a little bit about what you're getting into, you think, or?
Right. So I want to say that we didn't live on base. We lived out in the economy in the neighborhoods. You know, obviously there were military families in that area. If not, you know, we wouldn't be living there, but sure. It wasn't a base per se. You know, in Taiwan, we lived in two different houses. I remember the first house we lived up on a hill, there was a little day school and kindergarten school behind the house, and the kids would be singing. And, you know, and so at that time, I hadn't started school yet. So we had a nanny, and my brother had just been born. So she would speak Chinese to him. Huh. And my mother got upset. She's like, I will not be able to communicate with my son if he learns Chinese.
Yeah.
And so her daughter stepped in and started speaking English, but her mom would take care of my brother, you know. But her name was Susie. And we actually went to her wedding out in the country. You see the rice paddies and everything, and they lived up on this little hill. So you saw how people lived. You saw their culture and
yeah.
and everything they did. We did experience a funeral, which was quite interesting. What was interesting is that during the funeral, they had these ladies who would drape themselves in these white hooded capes, and they were professional criers. So they would go there and
just to cry,
just to cry, you know. So those things are very different culture, you know,
yeah.
but we lived off base. And so we were able to experience the culture and the places where we live. So being on base, I know my daughter spoke to this this week, being on base when I was in pilot training. She would come home from school, drop all her things, run out the back door, and there were other military kids running up and down the street. They would play, and it's the first time that I heard her say this, and there's a lot of things that her as a child growing up, you know, I learn in little conversations like this.
Sure.
You know, she doesn't come out and say it, you know, God, this sucks, or whatever. But she said she loved that. She loved being on base and running out and playing with friends. And I was like, wow, that's one of the things I never experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very different experience for her versus what it was for me. But I think kids in the military have a common community and they're very comfortable in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel very safe in it as well because they know that what their parents do, every other parent. And so it's an equalizer, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we're all here doing the same thing, serving our country in whatever capacity that is. So,
yeah.
You were telling me earlier that as a kid, she thought everybody's mom was a pilot.
Right. Right. We spoke to that this week. And so she was in middle school and I would go pick her up in my flight suit. I was still active duty and I'd pick her up and one of her teachers said, oh, wow, who's that? And she goes, oh, that's my mom. And she goes, oh, my God, she's a pilot. You know, she just went on ranting and she needs to come speak to the class. And my daughter's looking at her like,
it's my mom.
It's my mom.
Like,
what? It's just my mom. You know, what's the big deal? So she didn't realize that was something different, that, you know, the role that I had in my profession was so unique.
Mm-hmm.
So she just figured every other mom, yeah, pilot.
Yeah.
No big deal.
The stories we have today are really interesting, but before we go any further, I do want to take a moment to acknowledge our sponsor. They are some of the people who help make the Green Dot possible. And that is Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all of your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, you can save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use coupon code GREEN15. That's GREEN15 at crewchiefsystems.com. Thank you again so much to Crew Chief Systems for sponsoring the Green Dot and helping make it possible. Now let's get back to the rest of the story. So let's talk about some of this pilot training that as you're rolling into it. What was that progression like? Like, what type of aircraft did you fly, and what were some of the like instructional courses like that you did?
Sure. So once I got my commission, we went off. Edwin was active duty, and our daughter had just turned, she was 3.5 when I started, and she turned 4. So here we are. He's enlisted. I'm an officer, and we have this 4-year-old daughter. So coming in, being the only female in the class, obviously it's kind of like civilian training. You start with ground school, you do physiological training, you learn how to do PLFs, parachute landing falls. Not fun. They take you out into the field and hook you up to a harness with a parachute on your back, and they pull you with a pickup truck, and they get you airborne about 300 feet. And then they just stop the truck and then watch you glide down and see how you do your parachute landing fall, right? I'm like, and I landed on a cactus.
Ugh. Oh, no.
And I'm like, oh, my God, okay, are we done? Nope, we're going to do it again. This time we're going to pull you, and we're going to go up 400 to 500 feet, and we're going to cut the rope loose.
Oh.
So now you're just going to be floating in the wind, see where you fall, and sure enough, you know, at least that one went well. I'm going, can I check this box?
Yeah. Can we be done here?
I am done. But, you know, so that was the initial training. And then from there, we went to T-37. So T-37s was the equivalent, the trainer for the A-37s at the time. And then that was the initial phase of pilot training. Quite interesting, being the only female in the squadron, you know, they had to have signs on the bathroom doors and that sort of thing. So they weren't prepared for women yet. And then from that phase, I went into the T-38. Now I have to say, my favorite aircraft of all time is a T-38. Hmm. And I would see that when the networks on TV would sign off at night. Mm-hmm. There was no 24/7 TV networks, you know, streaming, none of that. And I would see the White Rocket and High Flight was being played in the background with music. And it was like, oh, my God. And I remember one night, that's the same year that we were landing on the moon. So I'm sitting here watching sign off, looking at the moon, knowing there's somebody on the moon. And and it was like, wow, that would be a dream. You know, I still want to say I do want to go to space. So I'm just putting that out there to anybody who's listening. I am open to the idea.
I love it.
And I'm here.
I'm here.
I love that.
So, but anyway, so that was the best. And I think I thrived in the second phase. I mean, I just felt right at home. My best type of flying is formation flying.
Oh, nice.
Love it. Just love it. You know, when you're about 3 feet away from an airplane and you're just going 300 knots and just amazing, you know, especially what the aircraft can do, you know. Mm-hmm. So I want to say during the T-38 phase of flight training, as challenging as it was, you know, I mean, keeping up with an airplane. So you're in the moment, but you're obviously miles ahead of the airplane, knowing where you need to be, what needs to happen next as you're still taking care of the airplane in the moment, right? Formation flying is, you know, it's fantastic. I did have a student try and kill me once, though. But we can talk about that later. But anyway, I just loved it. And because I thrived there, you know, I was able to graduate in the top percent of my class.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Well, and I love that the airplanes you're flying, you know, even though there's a T in front of them, those military aircraft were also used in frontline combat.
Yes.
I mean, the T-37 was the A-37 and used in Southeast Asia.
Right.
And, you know, the T-38 was, you know, the F-5. Single seat is the F-5. Yeah. And which they're still using today for aggressors and things like that. So still right. Still an airplane. That, I mean, the T-38s are still around too. I mean, it's a legacy airframe. I mean,
it is. It is.
So the T-37 is famous for its sound. They call it the dog whistle or
the Tweety bird.
Yes.
Yeah. It would tweet. Exactly. Thing would just go on, you know. That's why we had earmuffs all the time. You'd lose your hearing in a heartbeat if you didn't have those on out there.
What was that airplane like to fly?
Uncomfortable. Yeah. No, it was. You know, your instructor is sitting next to you. So as opposed to tandem, you know, it's side by side. And it was quite interesting. The phase that to me was the first time we did it, we do spins in that airplane. So they showed us video of what it would look like from
your point of view.
Yes. Yeah. Sitting in the cockpit, what it would look out on the horizon, and you see sky, all dirt, all sky, all dirt. You're up and down, up and down. I'm like, that doesn't seem so bad. Oh my God. I have to admit, the first time my instructor took me up and we did that, he says, okay, watch. We're going to get into a spin. So he goes in and all the inputs, the airplane goes down into the spin. And as soon as the nose goes down,
yeah,
I shut my eyes. Oh. But we have helmets with visors. So he doesn't see me with my eyes closed. Uh-huh. And I'm like, okay, what's this going to feel like? So I'm experiencing the feeling of this. And then he comes out of it and he goes, okay, do you see that? I go, mm-hmm. yeah. And he goes, your turn. I'm like, okay, here we go. So I get into the spin. But as many times as we had to do it, that's one of the maneuvers I said, I will never get into a spin because I know exactly how the airplane gets into a spin.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make sure I never get this airplane into that position.
Yeah.
Because not that I couldn't recover it, but
you don't want to.
Why?
Yeah.
Why? You know, the good thing about a 38 is you could never do a spin. And if you did, you had to eject. I'm like, okay.
So, I'm not sure which would be better than that case.
I guess. I don't know. I never ejected, thank God, but I wouldn't want that either.
Yeah. Margaret, you know, when it's been a long time, but when I was doing my flight training in a Cherokee, we didn't do spins. Do you guys do spins in the Cessnas and stuff like that?
I did not do a spin in the. No, that good. Is. I don't know if you could. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Because it's such a stable airplane.
Yeah. I know,
well, you just let go and it flies itself out, right?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
So
I'm probably doing something real wrong.
Right. Yeah. If you get it to spin. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and then what was that transition like from the T-37 to the T-38? That had to be a pretty good bump in performance.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I ate it up. It was like amazing. Mm. You know, the speed, that jet's so sleek and sexy, if you will.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful. And to be able to do that and get into it the first time, knowing that I had seen it on TV and, you know, I was pinching myself that
you were doing it. Yeah.
That whole first flight, it was like, oh my God, I have arrived, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I am here. And like I said, so grateful for all of that. But I, being top percent, I was able to select my first choice, which was the T-38. It was the fastest aircraft women could fly with the fighter rating that we needed to be able to get into that. But, you know, because of Congress and exclusion and all that, women weren't being able to be assigned any fighter aircraft. So it was the fastest jet that a female could get into at the time.
Sure.
And a lot of people say, oh, you were a FAPE. And, you know, they kind of knocked that first phase of initial weapon system, if you will, for a lot. You know, you need to go out there and fly a real airplane. I go, I don't know. This is the best airplane I can.
Seems pretty real.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It just looks like what a fighter should look like.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful airplane.
It does. And the G's are
That's fine. And I mean, you were in the same network or same airframe. I mean, the astronauts fly T-38s.
Exactly. I
mean, that's
cool. Yeah. I still want to go to space.
I was going to say, so that's just one more.
Little transition. Yeah exactly. So at what, I mean, when you get your wings pinned on you, that has to be a day that will just stand out forever. Can you tell us about that day?
Absolutely. My parents had come into town. I think they were there for my last 2 months or so of training. And we lost a few students in our class along the journey. But I think we graduated maybe out of 50, 44, 45. So, you know, we were hanging in there. I do have to say we had a navigator who transitioned into pilot training, and he was a lifesaver. When we got into instruments, the clue bird did not come into the building until he stood up and explained, this is what instrument, this is the three-dimensional world that you're going to be living in. And thank God he explained it, because I remember going to my husband and crying. I'm like, I'm not understanding what this instrument thing is all about and everything. And he worked at base operations. So they're in the safety office and in the weather department there that they had, and operations, there were a couple of pilots, and he went up to him and said, do you think you could help my wife? She's having a hard time with instruments. And so by that time, the nav guy stepped up, and I wasn't the only one.
Oh, I'm sure you weren't.
Yeah. So when I spoke up and I said, hey, do you think you could do this? All of a sudden, there's about five or six guys in my class behind me going, yeah, we want this too. I'm like, see, you know, that's what you get if you ask and you ask questions.
Yeah.
You know, they're all like, no, I got this. Yeah, right. You don't. And so that's how you get ahead. You know, you get asked for help. And so, yeah, he was a lifesaver. But when we graduated, my mom, who was totally against me going into the military, I mean, here I am married with a 3.5-year-old daughter, and she thought I was crazy. What are you doing? You have a family, you have a life, you have a job, you have all of this. And I told her, Mom, I have to do this.
Yeah.
I have to. If given the opportunity, this is what I want. When I graduated, she was the proudest mom ever.
I'm sure, yes.
Any opportunity that she had, oh, this is my daughter, she's a pilot, or, you know, and on and on and on. So, but I always tell people that, and especially young students, you know, to just surround themselves with people who support them.
Yep.
Because if somebody's in there telling you not to do something, you don't want those people in your life.
When you don't want that doubt to then kind of eat away, right? So a big takeaway from just listening to you talk is the belief in yourself, right? The entire time, like from when you were a little girl and to when you became a pilot, you believed you could do it and you pushed through and you don't need people coming in and eating away at that. You got to stay true to yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the first challenge is of overcoming that doubt.
Yeah.
So when people say, well, I'm not sure, I go, you have to step outside of that doubt.
Yep.
And believe in yourself. Mm-hmm. Even though you
might not have it all figured out.
No.
No one does.
No, of course not. Of course not.
Yeah.
So, but I tell them sometimes the people closest to you, like your family, are going to, like my mom did, put that doubt in you, like you can't do this. And I always tell young students, they're not doing it because they don't want you to succeed. They're doing it out of love because they're fearful of your inability to succeed.
Yeah, in a weird way, they're trying to protect you. Yeah.
Protect you, you know, and it's something they don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, and when they don't understand, they don't know how to help.
Yep.
And that's where that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely. But then for her to be there and be
beaming to pin that on my uniform was a great great moment for the whole family.
For all of you. Yeah.
For the whole family. And it's something that, looking back, you know, I'm glad we were always a close family. In the military, when you're away, your family unit is your life. Yeah. Everything revolves around that.
Yeah.
And you support each other, you protect each other. And that's something that I appreciate that, you know. And kind of like my husband and I, when we left the island and he went into the military, it was just he and I.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very young, but we always say we kind of grew up together, mm-hmm. depending on each other, mm-hmm. you know. And there's the 51 years.
Absolutely.
So when those wings get pinned on you,
mm-hmm.
and we're not giving anything away, it's part of your amazing story is you became the first Latina Air Force pilot in our country's history.
Yes.
Did you know at that moment?
No. So when you when you do something to become a first, to me, okay. But when you do something because you love it and want it, you know, first was never in my vocabulary.
It was never the goal.
Never the goal.
Right.
Never the goal. I just wanted to do this.
Yeah.
You know, and so to find out that here I am, now I represent this, I'm a first. But in the military, not only the first Latina, I was the first T-30 instructor pilot at Laughlin. I was the first T-38 instructor pilot at pilot instructor training in T-38s. So I did a lot of other firsts.
Sure.
Just being a female, you know. Forget the Latina part of it, yeah. you know, but not,
yep.
but still, you know,
wow.
So there were a lot of firsts. And I think because of the fact, and I want to say this, that I had a very stable relationship mm-hmm. in my home with my husband, my daughter. So I could go out there and take on these challenges.
Absolutely.
And be among this male-dominated world as a female. But I said, you know what? I fit in. And I visualized that,
mm-hmm.
you know, wearing very proudly those wings on my chest. And I looked at somebody else. I said, you got that the same way I got this. Mm-hmm. I didn't get any special treatment because I had to work as hard or who knows more than you did to earn those wings. So I knew that I had earned my place wherever mm-hmm. I stepped into.
That's awesome.
Wow. That is amazing. You're always such an inspirational person to talk to. I don't know if you even know, you gave me advice one time in your first visit here, and you said, if you have a dream, go say it, because once you put it out in the universe, it's out there. You have said it. You have to own that now, that is your dream. So,
yes.
Or something you want, you know.
Right, so, right. But I need to talk to Margaret about something later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, she shared a secret with me not too long ago.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Well, I talk a lot.
So that's okay.
We will find.
We'll do another podcast for that.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, your aviation career as amazing is in the military spans outside the military. I know
yes.
we're fighting the clock, so I do want to talk about it. First off, I do want to ask you, I want to know about the student that almost killed you.
Oh, yeah, sure. So in T-38s, we do formation flights, right? And one of the flights the students have to do is they have to fly solo in formation. So I have a student in the front of my aircraft and a solo student in another aircraft flying formation. So they all know the procedure, lost wingman, off he goes. And so the lead, you level off, right? And then you say, hey, I'm here, I'm holding, whatever. And I'm trying to find the student. I couldn't find him. I said, where are you? Where are you? The next thing I know, the guy's doing like a loop, comes right through my altitude, upside down next to us. Oh. And I'm like, oh my God. So there's no, you know, tracking or anything at that time, you know, it was all analog, no glass, no computers, nothing. And so here comes this T-38 coming through the horizon right next to us. And I just tell him, you level off. I'm going to give you an altitude. Stay down there. Do not climb up again. And I'm going to find you. So I had to go find him. And of course, you know, it was an unsat for the for the ride, because I said, when you go Lost Wingman, you go out there, you level off, you tell me where you are, and we go find you. You just don't come finding me and crashing through the horizon doing a loop, you know? So so that was quite scary. So.
Wow. Well, you also, after the military, went on to fly commercial heavies, right?
Yes, I did. It was a time of transition. I knew my next aircraft assignment was going to be either 141 or 135 or KC-10, whatever the situation was. It was going to be heavy. It was going to require us to move. By that time, my husband had separated from the Air Force, and he had a really good job as a DOD employee. He was a contracting officer, and the kids were pretty stable, you know, where they were. By that time, we had our son. And I thought about moving. And I figured, well, I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And then I thought about my service. I wanted to continue that. But I was trying to figure out, a lot of my peers were leaving for the airlines at the time. So there were a lot of things that I had to put in place in order to apply. So we talked. And I said, you know, I'm going to stay in the reserves because I started this and I want to finish this, my service. I think, you know, and I always say this, both uniforms that I've had in my profession, I stood the tallest and proudest in my Air Force uniform. You know, that every time I wore it, I think about it right now and I just feel chills and that sort of thing of the service that I was able to give. But yes, I had to transition, went to the reserves, and I said, I'm going to take a year off, saved a year's salary just in case. I didn't know what was going to happen. And then I had to start earning my flight engineer's license. So I had to study for that and get my license before I even applied. So it took a while. It took a while to get that because for the airlines, they needed you to have that radio operator license, which no big deal anyway. But the flight engineer license was a big deal and a commercial license. And so I had those things and I started applying to all the airlines that were looking at applications at the time. And I found American Airlines. You know, I mean, it was a long process just to do the interviews and everything. But I want to say it only took about 6 or 7 months to get that interview and get the process started. So, you know, less than a year, I started flying for them. I was a flight engineer on 727. Again, another great aircraft. Great aircraft, you know, sitting sideways in there. And then I moved up as the first officer. And my plan was just to keep moving up, you know, in the seats in that airplane. Then they started retiring it. And they started bringing in the super 80s, like DC-9s. And I would commute to work all the time. And I could tell, you know, they started hiring pilots right into the super 80. So they weren't hiring anybody into as a flight engineer. After a while. But I could tell new pilots for the landings. I'd say, oh, new pilot. Boom. So, you know, you learn to read the aerodynamic language, you know, of the airplane or what's happening and who's inputting, you know, all the controls in there. But from there, I went on and upgraded to a Fokker 100 because I always wanted to have a line. I waited till I held a line because if you sit reserve, it's so hard, especially commuting. So I waited to hold the line, upgraded to that. And then from there, I went to Miami, flew to the 7576 International. That was amazing. It was a two-leg commute, but totally worth it. But because of that as well, I kind of retired early because it's very hard on the body to do all this night flying and, you know, two-leg commute, sit in operations, find the pilot lounge sleep room and get about 2 hours of a nap. Than to go out and fly all-nighters. And then you wake up, whoever's landing it was, you know, the sun's in your eyes. You're like, oh my God, let me stay awake for this landing. You know, and so it was, but flew all of South America and then flew to Europe. My favorite was Madrid. Mm. That was it. I loved that.
Wow. What an amazing, amazing story, amazing career. You're a general aviation pilot now.
Yes.
Yeah.
All because of EAA, I have to say. It is.
Yeah.
Because we came here, and I have to thank you, Chris, and you're in the book.
What?
Well, in the acknowledgments. Because of this experience, I never thought I'd be flying again. You know, I figured, okay, I had my career, everything's good. And you see all these people that are passionate about flying, about airplanes. And so a lot of civilian pilots that move on and go either military or civilian, you know, commercial, they start off in 172 and all of that. And they build, they get their CFI and their instrument and they move on and multi. And I went right into jets, you know. So to come back and finish where most people start is unusual, right? And so very inspiring, so much that my husband said, I need to get you an airplane.
Ooh.
So I said, sure, why not? Let's do this.
Yeah.
So I have to thank the experience here. And especially, you know, like everybody says, you come for the airplanes and you
stay
come back
for the people.
For the people. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how I feel. I'm so proud. I became a life member of VAA.
Yay!
That's awesome.
And so I feel that committed and passionate about what you all do.
Well, it is absolutely an honor to get to spend time with you and call you guys both friends. I know.
And to have you be a part of this community.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, yeah. When Margaret said, oh, we're going to start the Women Venture, I'm like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, that was so exciting for me. I said, anything you need, Margaret, I'm here. You know, let me know how I can help. And, you know, we want to make sure that continues and becomes successful and it evolves into what it needs to be for this organization. And she did fantastic and is doing a great job.
Well, yeah, your words on the porch that day, like you probably don't remember, but I do. It's like you have that memory. And we were talking about Women Venture and just your support alone helped solidify for me that like, yep, this is what we need.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
And now we've grown it. So
yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I heard. So yeah, I missed last year, but we're coming back this year.
You're going to be here this year.
Yep.
It's going to be great.
For sure.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for everything, for being such a great inspirational figure here, always being so supportive of all the programs here. For those listening, every time, you know, we call Olga for anything, you're always like, I'll get on a plane, let's go. You know, so thank you guys for always just being so amazing. Thank you for your service as well.
Yes, my
thank
honor.
You.
My honor, you know, and we have to thank, I guess, the men and women, you know, after Vietnam, and everything they struggled through in order for every service member nowadays to say, have people thank them for their service. Mm-hmm. You know, it took a while to get to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so grateful that people recognize that now. So,
Well, absolutely. And I mentioned you're always so supportive of our program.
Yes.
For those listening, this is obviously pre-recorded, but you're here tonight to be a speaker in our museum. We're so looking forward to that. And just, again, thank you so much for traveling up to be here.
Anytime. Anytime.
You know we'll put that to the test.
She means it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Margaret, for being a wonderful co-host with me as always.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Yes. No, I appreciate both of you and everything you do.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And the last thank you goes out to our audience. We really appreciate everybody taking the time to listen. I love hearing the stories of us helping people cut the grass and things like that. They put on their headsets or headphones and listen to the Green Dot. So thank you. Thanks for the wonderful comments and feedback. You know, please keep those coming. We love to hear the positive stuff. The negative stuff, we just give to Tom. So it's all good. But no, seriously, appreciate it. And we will catch you next time when we're cleared to land on the Green Dot.